Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Stupidity, home of the greatest media mind ever to walk the planet.
Okay, so here's the deal. He's a true icon in every sense of the word.
He's loved and feared more than any being to grace this planet.
There's two guys. A man with a voice that sounds like Barry White and Beyonce had a Jewish baby.
God himself would pay $39.99 for a cameo. Fact of the matter is, you are about to embark on a transcendent experience that can only be described as psychological nudity.
This is Stugatz, and this is Stupidity.
Here we go, Jim.
Tony!
Billy, I have two questions for you.
Okay.
One, how shocked were you on a scale of 1 to 10 that I agreed and said yes to the author of Wasteland as a guest here on Stupidity?
I was very surprised, I would say. Okay. But also not surprised at the same time, if that makes sense. I was very surprised in the direction, the conversation that we're about to have, the topic, right? But I wasn't surprised in that, like, you'll go on these things where you will say yes to absolutely anyone that is pitched. And that's kind of like when I saw it, because you said yes to this when I was away. So I just got follow-up emails like, hey, can we schedule this? Stugatz said yes. And I was like, he did? And then I ask you and you're like, yeah, I really want to talk about this. I'm like, okay, like, let's do it.
So, Billy, he did that while you were on paternity leave, and he did it with me. And basically, he said yes to everything and then said, let Billy schedule it.
Oh, great. Okay, perfect. This is starting to make more sense now. Yeah. I did arrive back to a number of emails from the people that help us with guest booking saying, we got yeses on, blah, 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 from Stugatz. And I was like, okay. So then I scheduled all these things, and we scheduled like 3 months worth of episodes, like in the span of like 2 weeks. And it was like, there were just so many that part of me was like, who's trying to pull one over on me? Because Stugatz has said yes, it seems like absolutely everything. Are the guest bookers trying to take advantage of the fact that I was away and just telling me that he said yes to everything? Did he just say yes to everything because he didn't want to say no and hurt anyone's feelings? Like, what happened here? By the way, this is a great interview. So let me not, like, let me not.
It's a make fantastic it seem
like
interview.
We're not interested that we're like laughing at the interview. It is a good interview. It was just surprising.
It was odd for me to say yes to it. It's something Levitard would say yes to. So what I'm wondering, Billy, and then from there, both of you, I'm asking you, how surprised were both of you and how prepared I was for this
interview? Even more surprised by that. Even more surprised by that. Because going into it, I said, Stugatz, we have this interview today. You know, make sure, like, do you know what you want to talk? You had a list of questions you had that you wanted to know where garbage went. You had questions about the ocean. You had more questions than you had time to ask. And you were very concerned about the environment, yeah, what we're doing with trash, where it's ending up. And I was like, who is this person?
I have a theory I want to float by, and I tell me if I'm close here. Did you read the title of Wasteland wrong and think it was Wasted Land and it was about something else? And then all of a sudden realize what it's about and go, oh shit, I better do some prep, and then you overcorrected.
I thought the book was about something else.
Wasted Land, maybe?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Yep. It's exactly what happened. And then I realized, I better do some prep for this guy because I have no idea what's going on with garbage. And what's going on is awful.
You thought you were going to be talking dead shows, and instead you're talking about, you know, Earth death.
Yep.
Do you think we're the dumbest people that he's ever spoken to?
He would be Oliver Franklin Wallace, the author of Wasteland, who is very, very smart, a very good journalist, and a big-time author. Yes, I do think I'm the dumbest person he's ever spoken to, yes.
Well, so I think he was very nice. He was very knowledgeable. When he was talking to us, it kind of reminded me of, like, career day at school. You know what I mean? Where, like, you just dumb it down for children and you explain, like, what you do at a very basic level. And you're like, here's, you know, I'm a senator. This is what I do. I go and I pass laws. And it's like a very basic thing. And it's like, let me make sure these dumb-dumbs understand just basic information and the book that I'm trying to sell. And then hopefully their audience will be smarter than them.
Yeah. Yes. But Mikey, to your point, and we'll talk to Oliver Franklin Wallace, the author of Wasteland, in a minute. I thought it was a book about getting wasted.
Mm. Shouldn't he have a number at the end of his name? Like, shouldn't he be like the third or the fourth?
Yes. Only like, the third. Yes.
Yeah. Like, I feel like just with a name like that, you got to have a number at the end.
Yep. Oliver Franklin Wallace, the author of Wasteland. I was more prepared for this than I was for the interview I just did with Ian Rappaport on another show. What? Stupidity. Stu Gatz here for my friends over at Miller Lite. A lot's changed over the years. One thing that hasn't, the great taste of Miller Lite. Another thing that hasn't changed is that it's less filling. So, what is the best thing about the original light beer? Miller Lite sparked this debate in 1975, and we still haven't settled it. For me, it is simple. What I want out of my light beer is ice cold and great taste, and that's exactly what I get from the original light beer, Miller Lite. Miller Lite keeps it simple, undebatable quality, great taste, only 96 calories. It's the beer that strips away everything you don't need and holds on to what matters most. A light beer that tastes like beer. You don't have to choose what's best. Miller Lite has great taste and is less filling. Tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right to your door, visit MillerLite.com/stew, or you can find it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, 96 calories per 12 ounces, fewer calories and carbs than premium regular beer. Oliver Franklin Wallace is an author. He's a very good author. He's an accomplished author, and he has written a book called Wasteland. It's fascinating. It is a fascinating topic, and I am wondering, of all the things, Oliver, you could have written about, why'd you choose this?
Yeah, I know. I told my friends when I started out this program, they're like, oh, I'm writing a book, and they got so excited. They're like, what is it about? I'm like, oh, it's about trash, and you just get these kind of like weird looks from people. And I would, you know, I spend a lot of time going around the world reporting, and I'd be like going to India and Ghana and all these kind of interesting places. And people thought it was very glamorous. You know, you're going to India and they're like, oh, what are you going to do in India? Are you going to go see the Taj Mahal? And I'm like, no, I'm going to one of the world's largest landfills. But to me, that's great. You know, it's an interesting world. It's not always the most glamorous place. But yeah, it's an interesting place to be. And it's like a side of the world that you don't really think about until you start thinking about what, you know, the garbage cans are like this magic trick. You put things inside it and then they just like magically disappear. But the thing that I was kind of fascinated by is this idea that the you know, the disposal chain is quite often as long and as complicated as the supply chain. When we talk about where things come from, or whether they're fair trade or they're organic or what have you. But no one really thinks about where they go. And quite often it's just as long and fascinating a journey.
What's the most jaw-dropping thing you discovered about the global waste industry as you put this book together? Because it is fascinating, man. I was mortified some of the shit that you wrote.
Can I swear on this podcast? Is that
yes.
Okay?
Yes.
I think the sheer amount of bullshit in this industry and in this world kind of staggered me. Like, you look back the decades and you see, Coca-Cola was making these recycling pledges in the mid-90s, and like they just didn't do it and nobody followed up to check. And then they were doing it like 1995, 2005, 2007, 2010. And every time you have these big companies being like, no, we're going to clean up our acts now. And they never do. They never have done. So seeing some of that, and like we can talk about it later, but like the fact that recycling as we know it was kind of invented as like a greenwashing, you know, it's like a sustainability play by big corporates to get away with like essentially dumping a lot of their products on us without being legislated against. So there's kind of this fascinating history. But if you want to talk about the number, like the sheer numbers, the scale is kind of wild. One of my favorite ones is that we throw away about a third of all food grown worldwide. Which is like a staggering figure when you've got 820 million starving people in the world. But when you actually think about the farmland wasted, it means like 20% of, I think it's the figure is 28% of all farmland is used to grow food that's never eaten. And if you counted up all those acres, all those hectares, it would cover the entire subcontinent of India. So you like think of the amount of farmland that we literally are just totally wasting, and it kind of explodes your brain a little bit.
I think you just exploded Billy's brain and Mikey. They both had the same reaction. What happened to the both of you right there? It's crazy, right?
I mean, what happens to it all? Like, all this food is getting grown. Like, what happens to it?
Oh, well, I mean, things get wasted for so many reasons. You know, there's things like farm loss on farm is like a big thing that we don't talk about a lot. You know, some of this stuff happens by natural disaster or things like that. But a big thing, and what the thing that kind of really appalled me in the book is, you know, retailers will tell you that most of the stuff we throw away in the case of food happens at home, right? You buy too much food, it sits, it rots away in the fridge, you get to the end of the month and things are a little bit funky, and you end up throwing away 3/4 of your bag of salad or whatever. And your bread, like old moldy loaves of bread and all this kind of stuff that gets thrown away. But then there's kind of these little pockets of things, and you realize, you know, how much restaurants and the fast food industry and those kind of things, the waste on that scale is right. So, for example, like you have these little light bulb moments. So, for example, I remember reading or noticing for the first time that if you go into a shop and buy a sandwich, like I don't know if this is a big thing in the US, if you like buy a pack, like a sandwich in a packet, they never make them with the crusts. So like it's like where do all the crusts go? And then you add it all up and it's like something like 400,000 loaves of bread worth of crusts in the UK alone are thrown away every year just by like the packaged sandwich industry. And you're like, holy goodness, you know, just those kind of tiny things, and you realize the scale of the waste. And you want to talk about farmers. Farmers are obsessed with this stuff, right? Because in the book, I went to farms and saw the scale of like the industrial amount of vegetables and stuff that goes to waste, and it's just left rotting in the fields. And one of the couple of main reasons, one is that big retailers have these crazy cosmetic standards. Like they won't sell an apple that has a blemish on it. So everything has to be perfect and the same uniform size and shape, and getting things to reach something. You know, if you want to sell your produce in Whole Foods, it's got to be beautiful. And anything that's not beautiful, chances are it's going to, you know, it's getting dug back into the soil or it's going in the blender. And, you know, when you the second thing that you have is that you get these huge retailers and they sign these contracts with farmers which say, okay, we're gonna want 100,000 tons of okra or whatever this season, and then suddenly the weather changes or like they see some buying pattern change, and they'll just be like, oh, actually we only ever wanted 800,000 tons or whatever, and they'll cut the order by 20%, and by then it's already in the ground and it's too late for the farmers to really do anything. Like they're scrambling around trying to find a market for it. So a huge amount of food waste happens because of like just the weirdly economics of like food growing and farmers. So farmers are like living this stuff day to day. And if you went across the Midwest or anywhere in the UK, they would tell you that it's kind of wilder than even you think.
You talked about Coke earlier, and I think you call it greenwashing recycling. Can you explain to people in layman's terms exactly what it is Coca-Cola was doing?
Yeah, sure. I mean, so Coca-Cola produces a very large number of, it's the exact tonnage and the number of bottles is in the book, but there's about 480 billion, I think, plastic bottles sold worldwide every year, if you want to kind of try and visualize that. I worked out how many times that would stretch you to the moon and back, but it's more than a couple of times. But, you know, Coca-Cola for a long time have pledged that, okay, we're going to put some recycled plastic in our bottles to try and minimize the amount of virgin plastic and therefore fossil fuels we're mining from the ground. Every time they've made that pledge so far, they haven't made it. As far as I know, I'm not up to date with their most recent pledge, but it seems unlikely to me. So, yeah, I mean, and that's the latest like in a long, long line of corporate greenwashing with our waste that goes back to the 1950s. Because after the Second World War, we had the kind of consumer, great golden era consumer boom, and suddenly we had all these white goods and plastics, which basically didn't exist prior to that at any kind of scale, happened. You know, I talk about in the book that for like the idea of disposables, like disposable packaging, disposable cutlery, those kind of things, didn't really exist until basically the 1940s when you have the arrival of the disposable diaper. Before that, it meant like extra, a nice bonus. So you talk about people's disposable income. They weren't really using it as like disposable forks weren't really a thing in the same way, right? So we have as you know, the global north, all of these economies are like, okay, what do we do with all this stuff? And there was a push to legislate to basically make companies pay their way and in you know, paying money towards the waste disposal system to make sure that it was getting disposed of instead of ending up in like highway hedgerows and, you know, in the environment. And a few of the packaging companies got together and they formed this action group called Keep America Beautiful. And one of the things that this action group did was it launched a very famous series of ads. There's a very famous ad with like called the Crying Indian ad, but it basically said that the problem was due to litterers, and they invented this term, the litter bug, and the litter bug was the person who was filling the environment with all this stuff, and not the companies who were kind of pumping them out into the world, knowing that they were essentially, you know, never going to biodegrade. And you had similar campaigns that was very successful, had similar campaigns all over the Western world, the global north. And we kind of still live with that attitude to waste now. Like, it's a little bit like a lot of people don't know, for example, that the carbon footprint was an idea popularized by the oil company British Petroleum. Like, that's we all talk about carbon footprint because of the oil industry wanted to basically blame it all on us. So it's a very similar thing happened with waste. And we're kind of still living with the repercussions. You know, anytime we have a big discussion around, okay, well, why is there all of this plastic in our oceans? It's kind of like, well, we need to do better jobs of like washing out our yogurt pots, and not, okay, well, maybe we need to find a way to make sure that, you know, waste collection is funded all around the global south, where about only like 2 billion people don't have any kind of formalized waste collection at all. So the idea of the garbage man is just alien in huge parts of the world, which is something that blew my mind, and I think blows a lot of people's minds when you think about it. And you want to know why the ocean's full of plastic. It's because 2 billion people don't have, you know, trash collection, so it ends up in the environment. Jeez. Which is a huge environmental and human challenge.
So littering's fine then, because it's really the companies that are to blame. That's what you're saying.
I don't think it's quite what I said. I mean, it's, for real though.
Our fault. That's all, right?
Well, I just think that like sometimes we are convinced that like the answer is to buy more stuff or like feel guilty about the tiny things that you're doing in your life, when the reality is like, if the procurement guy at Nike or someone who's in packaging design at Coca-Cola makes one slightly different decision on a Thursday morning design meeting, they can kind of save more plastic than every single person, you know, recycling all of their plastic pots in the entire country, you know? So like the I'm not saying that you should litter. I'm just saying like the people who can really make a difference, you know, it's not, you're not going to solve this problem in the grocery aisle.
Well, so to not be grim then, like there's not a whole lot that we as average citizens can really do to solve this problem, because it's bigger than us.
Well, I think that I don't think that that's true.
I don't mean it to say like, why even bother trying? You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's not like a thing where it's like, I can go out and I have to recycle every day and I will solve this problem on my own, because it's bigger than that.
It's way bigger than that. Yeah.
Yeah, and I do think that there's this kind of challenge, which is people, you know, talk to people about this and they're like, okay, well, I can do it. And I'm like, well, you can do a lot of stuff. You can, you know, first of all, you could buy less stuff that you don't need, which I'm sure we'll talk about later. But, you know, you can recycle effectively and you can reuse and repair things. And we can do all of the things that would be kind of better for the environment. But I'm saying, like, individually, you're not going to solve the problem because of, you know, if you just talk about the rate of growth in waste production in the global south, for example, 1.3 billion extra tons of waste being produced globally by 2050, I think, is the World Bank projection. So that doesn't all mean that we should, like, see climate change and be like, oh, I'm not going to buy an electric car because it's not going to solve a drop in the ocean. We all have a collective responsibility to do it, for sure. I think that the thing that we need to sometimes be mindful of is solutions that, like, involve us buying new stuff. Okay, just buy this expensive tote bag, buy this expensive water bottle or whatever, and you'll feel better. And, like, not dealing with the systemic issues. A lot of people have come to me and they're like, oh, well, recycling's broken, so we just shouldn't bother. I'm like, no, recycling's broken, so we should fix it. You know, if I told you that clothing is made in sweatshops, your response is, oh, well I'm going to stop buying shoes. You're like, well, no, because you need shoes. You're going to find ethical ways to produce shoes and maybe pay those people a bit better. So I think that we need to kind of have this approach of, okay, let's iterate and fix problems rather than, you know, abandoning them wholesale. And, like, let's just tone the rhetoric down a little bit, see where the things are broken and the opportunities to fix it, because there are opportunities to fix it. And I talk about some of them in the book, and I'm sure we'll talk about some of them here.
The book is Wasteland. Check it out. It's pretty fascinating, man. Oliver Franklin Wallace is the author. He's with us right now here on Stupidity. Who's trying to fix it? Like, who is? Like, what is trying? Like, what are people trying to do?
Oh, God, I mean, like,
trying to do it.
The crazy thing is that Well, I started this book back in 2019, which feels like a long time ago to me. I've had, like, an extra kid and stuff since then. So in those pre-pandemic days, it feels like a long time. Pre-pandemic feels a lifetime ago.
How many kids do you have?
I got two.
Exactly.
And yes, they my youngest still has disposable nappies, so you can hang me for it. The crazy thing is, like, seeing the rate of change is wild. You know, you and I are talking here now, the UN is debating a plastics convention, which, when I started this book, just seemed totally unthinkable. And if you talk to activists in this space, they'd been like, there's no way that's ever going to happen. You have, like, state legislatures in the US passing right to repair laws, saying to, you know, big tractor companies and car companies, okay, phone companies, okay, you've got to make things and let us repair them. And standing up to the corporate interests who are trying to sell you stuff and, like, that you're locked into and can't be fixed anymore. So to see the groundswell of support for some of this stuff has been crazy and really encouraging, you know, like, because to me, we talk about climate change a lot and people say, well, why would you fight, you know, aren't there bigger things that you want to worry about than waste? And I'm like, well, food waste, the IPCC reckons that food waste is about 8% of all global CO2 emissions, so all global greenhouse gas emissions. So you can simultaneously feed hungry people and solve the climate change problem just by throwing less food away. That seems like a super easy win, right? Yeah. This is the low-hanging fruit stuff. Solid waste is 5% of all global greenhouse gases. That's more than the entire shipping and aviation industry combined. So, like, when we talk about the scale of these problems, it's gigantic. So this should be these are the easy things to fix. And it's much easier to get people, like, if we touch this stuff every day, we are all dealing with it on a day-to-day basis. Everything in those rooms, I can see you guys in your rooms, everything around you is going to be trash one day, right? Like, so we are all living this stuff every day. If we can't solve that problem, how are you going to deal with invisible emissions going out of some factory in Indonesia or China or something? So to me, it's like an opportunity rather than a problem.
Billy's a hoarder. Is he doing it correctly? He won't throw anything away. I mean,
oh, yeah. If I just collect a bunch of stuff but never throw it away, am I doing a good thing for the environment?
Well, it's not, as long as it's not decomposing, I would say, yeah, maybe. I mean, the real talk answer to that is, like, the majority of the waste that is produced in our economy is produced upwind from us, up the chain from us. 97%, there's this estimate, and it's a bit outdated and it's not precise, but you can use, like, the Canadian figures, which is like 97% of all waste produced by weight is industrial waste, which is another thing where, like, people say, well, it's all very well saying, you know, buy less stuff. But I'm like, if you really want to make a difference, you could just, you know, buy one less thing to hoard, and that will probably offset the majority of the other things that you're doing. Now, I like to use the example when I talk to people about, you know, buying less stuff, that doesn't sound very exciting. And I said, well, no, buy better stuff. Like, if you can, because not everyone can. But as, like, if we all thought about stuff. You take a classic car community, right? You see guys who are like really, they got like a 60s Mustang and they take really good care of it and they're out there every Sunday waxing it and buffing it. And, you know, maybe they've carefully repaired the engine, or sometimes they're like, you see these communities and they're like upgrading them to electric engines and stuff now. And that guy who hasn't changed his car since the 1960s has probably got a lower carbon footprint than the guy driving the brand new Prius, because they've had like four cars in the intervening years, and the embodied carbon in those four cars like offsets the less efficient engine of this 60s car that you're driving, right? So, but what I'm trying to say is, I'm not saying everyone should drive 1960s gas guzzlers. I'm saying, like, if we took a little bit of care and looked after stuff long term, not only do you get a better carbon, you know, you get better carbon emissions, but you also get things that you love and that are beautiful and that you take pride in, and that, like, there's value in that I feel like sometimes we've lost in our like super fast consumer society. When's the last time you bought a t-shirt that you like really loved, you know, from the local store that cost you $5 or whatever, and was made in a Bangladeshi like fast fashion factory? So if we can kind of get back a little bit of that care for our things, I think that everyone's kind of better off in a lot of ways, and spiritually among them.
You seem, well, maybe angry is the wrong word. You seem frustrated because there seems to be some easy steps we all can take, and yet we're not taking them. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I am angry in some ways. Like, I'm not going to be, when you see some of the stuff that goes on in this world, so like some of the greenwashing, you know, it really frustrates me when I see big companies, like these big international conglomerates in the West, talking up their like latest recycling like initiatives or whatever, and at the same time, like with the other hand, they're like pumping billions of plastic sachets into economies like India and stuff in the global South, and that they know aren't recyclable, and like not doing anything about it, and that is like rampant. So things like that do get me like fired up, and I think we should all care about it. So there's that side of things, but I think one of the things that made me most kind of moved and agitated in this story is, you know, there's a chapter in the book. I went to Ghana. People don't know Ghana is a country in West Africa, and to write about thrift store donations. Most people don't know that when you donate stuff to a thrift store, only about between 10% and 30% of that stuff is actually resold in store. The majority of it is sent to these kind of big warehouses where it's like sorted and graded. And then it's exported to the global South, to the developing world. And there's a huge, you know, so this, the secondhand is like a huge global economy, not just clothes, electronics, cars, everything, you know, like lots of things have these second lives in the global South that you never see. Now, in countries like Africa and in like Ghana in Africa and across West Africa, they have been flooded particularly since the 1980s with more and more clothing donations. And a lot of what we donate now is fast fashion. By fast fashion, I mean the kind of stuff that you buy from H&M or a Zara. It's cheaply made, quickly made, and it's designed to be used a couple of times and then thrown away. And there is now so much stuff flooding these economies that they basically can't possibly use it all. So I met the guy who deals, the guy in charge of the sanitation department of Accra, which is the capital of Ghana. And he told me that they have this one sanitary landfill for the entire city. Like, a sanitary landfill is one that's kind of safe and you know, environmentally sound. And it was paid for with this loan from the World Bank. And it was designed to last about 30 years. And they filled it up in about 3.5 with all of this clothing waste. And now, inevitably, when there's clothing waste, a lot of the time there's like plastic fibers and other stuff going in. It burns very well, and you're dealing with a very hot country. The entire thing caught fire and burned to the ground. This guy's like a burly guy in his 40s who's crying, telling me this story. And he said, you know, he said, so the people of Ghana, who are some of the poorest people in the world, are still going to be paying interest for the next 20 years on a landfill that we can't use because you sent us all of your garbage, because it's filled with your garbage. Man. And he was like, why are we paying for your waste? Like, and the answer is like, I genuinely don't know. But I do know that when companies do pay into these things called extended producer responsibility schemes, so you know, companies pay a little bit of extra money and it goes towards trash collection, most of that money tends to stay in the global north, in the rich countries, right? And these poor countries aren't seeing any of that stuff, but that's where it ends up. So to me, I think that any solutions we're talking about, the UN and these international treaties and stuff, any solutions to these problems need to make sure the money is going to the people who need it and where this stuff is ending up, because like you see these places and the reality is horrifying.
What's the place you've seen or the thing you've seen as you were putting this together that was the toughest thing for you to see? Was it that? Was it something else?
No, I mean, anytime you deal with waste, you're dealing with some of the world's poorest people. You know, I went to India. India is now the world's most populous country as of earlier this year. It has a huge waste problem. You know, the explosion of people has gone from being very poor to now kind of having this big disparity between the richest there and the poorest, who are still extraordinarily poor. And I went to this landfill called Ghazipur, which is on the outskirts of New Delhi. And this thing is I describe it as the mountain in the book, but I genuinely mean that it's like 200 feet tall. It's about like the size of several thousand football fields. You can see it from miles away. Like it genuinely looks like a small mountain that you can see like looming across the edge of the city. And there are hundreds, if not thousands, of people living essentially on a town on this landfill. And their job is to, you know, they make their livelihoods by picking out recyclables from this waste and selling them onto the recycling market, onto recycling dealers. And waste pickers like this are pretty common for much of the world across the global South, South America, Central America, Southeast Asia. And, you know, to tell you these people are poor is kind of grossly oversimplifying things. You know, we're talking people living eight people to a room, that kind of thing. And I met this mother, and the kids were playing with the stuff that had been thrown away. Like they were taking toys out of the trash. They were blowing these little kids were taking out bubble mixture from the trash and like finding the little stuff left over in the jar and blowing it. And I was talking to their parents, and the mum said, you know, leave my daughters, take them with you. You know, and so when someone's offers you their kids, you know, because they know that they have very little hope of bettering themselves and their life, it's very difficult as a journalist, as a person, as a human being, to know what to say in those moments. So moments like that. When I was in Accra, I was in an informal settlement. Don't call them slums anymore, but that's essentially what it is. Called Old Fatima, which is on this lagoon in the city. It's where some of the poorest people in Accra live. And this guy, so something interesting happened there in the last few years, which was there was this big slum called Agbogbloshie, which was a processing hub for electronics waste. A lot of electronics were going there, and people were essentially like burning the wires apart and basically stripping them for the metals, because metals are very valuable wherever you go in the world. But it became this kind of like viral YouTube sensation. A bunch of like YouTubers turned up with their camera and kind of shot these kind of horrifying footage of like teenagers burning like toxic fumes. And so what the government did was it basically rolled in during the pandemic and bulldozed the whole place to the ground, partly because it was like giving them a bad reputation. And when I came, like the locals were absolutely furious, and they were like, what the hell are you doing here? He's just going to betray you. Like, don't talk to him. And I had to be like, you know what? They're right. Like, what I'm doing is not going to directly help you. Like, my hope is that I can affect policy change and things like that. But as a journalist, you come into these places. I'm not an NGO. I'm not Greenpeace. I don't have a big checkbook. I'm not the Bill Gates Foundation. And that's difficult. It's a difficult thing to do and to face. And I hope I can be upfront. I was upfront with them about it, and I hope I can be upfront with the reader about what they're seeing and who really has the power to make change. Because I'm hoping that, you know, the people who read this book feel moved enough to make a difference for those people, because, you know, I'm just a guy with a pen and a notepad a lot of the time.
Oliver Franklin Wallace, the book is Wasteland. It's available now wherever you buy your books. Top three things you want the audience to know, our audience to know about this problem.
Gosh.
Top three most, I know, it's tough, but if you had three things you could tell the audience right now, what would you tell them?
That's a very good question. You're putting me on the spot here. So I'm going to say, I'll give you three kind of quick and easy solutions.
Because these guys know me, and I'm not usually, this is not a subject I would normally like agree to do an interview on, but this has been like, it's fascinating to me and it's jarring. And so I want the audience to know like what they could do to, you know, help stop it, what they should know, you know?
For sure. And I think it's a really good question. The first thing would be buy less and buy better. We talked a little bit about that already. The second thing would be like learn to repair stuff, like find something in your life that you don't have to like start darning your socks. But you know, if you've got a games console, I've recently, you know, I've got a Nintendo, I swapped out the controllers recently, repaired those, something a lot of your listeners will probably relate to. Little things like that are skills that you can learn and make things last longer and actually have like an outsized impact. And the last thing, which is maybe slightly less obvious, and this is more of a kind of global call, but like demand that companies and the people and the waste industry tell the truth. One of the kind of most profound things and shocking things for me in this whole journey was I found out that essentially countries like the UK and the US, they publish this data about like how much stuff is being recycled. And you know, we talked a lot about recycling. The book's not just about that. There's a whole chapter on nuclear waste and the sewage and all kinds of wild stuff in there, and big incinerators and things. But we have this recycling, the national recycling rate. And the thing that I basically found out is that the entire way that we measure recycling is based on this fundamental lie. And the reason it's based on a fundamental lie is this, is that they count something as recycled basically when it goes through the front door of the factory. You picture the garbage, the truck, it pulls in the front door of the factory and someone ticks a box and says, yep, that was recycled. They don't measure it. So it's an input measure. They don't measure what's actually being recycled there and coming out the other side. And so I went to this huge gleaming new plastics recycling facility in the UK that does plastic bottles, you know, soda bottles. They're like one of the most common forms of waste we throw away. And they were like, I was like, okay, what's your yield? Like, how much are you actually recycling? And they were like, it's about 50%. So the actual recycling rate is half what we're all like sitting around here claiming it is. Now, what's wild to me is that there are like legally binding international treaties that are based on these recycling figures. Like the EU, every country is like pledged to reach a 50% recycling rate by, I think it's 2030. And like, we can't even tell the truth about that. Do you know what I mean? Like the if your first thing, you ship a container full of waste to a port and it gets loaded onto a ship to China. And like literally the moment sets off into the distance, it's tick, it's been recycled, and no one's ever checking like what's happening at the other side. And then you see this footage of these fields of waste in like China and Turkey and stuff that's just being burned in open fields, and you're like, this is wild. So the biggest, like, most obvious, this probably feels like a basic answer, but the biggest thing is like, we just need to tell the truth and like get a sense of what's actually happening to this stuff, because a lot of the time it's just lies. Like, it's like all the way down. The truth isn't there. Something as basic as, well, let's find out how much of this stuff is actually being recycled. What actually is happening to the stuff we throw away?
You're angry, and you should be. Because now you're making me angry.
Well, yeah, I hope people read this. Like, yeah, everyone I talk to when I tell this stuff, they get pretty mad too. I should say it's not all depressing. It's fun, and you know, I went dumpster diving. You know, you go dumpster diving with free guns and all this kind of stuff. And there's fun parts of the journey that have been in the people that I've met along the way who've become friends and things. So it has been fun to me. But yeah, when you put me on the spot, like,
yeah, dive. Yeah, what, definitely any... piqued Billy's curiosity. I saw him perk up there on a dumpster dive.
Any good finds? What do we see there?
I mean, it was the stuff that I was doing, the like dumpster divers are kind of weird because. Weird because they're dumpster divers, but like often they have like this like preternatural sense. Like, I'd be walking down the road with this guy, John, who I went dumpster diving with, who's this he has the record for the person in the UK with the lowest carbon footprint because they did this wild like weird competition. But he's a freegan, which means he doesn't buy any food. He only eats what other stuff people throw away. So his entire livelihood is fishing stuff out of bins. But he would like, we'd be walking down a road and he'd be like, oh, I think there's something good over there. And you're like, you would go and look inside and there'd be like all these like valuable metals and stuff that he could like sell to the trash dealer. And that's how he makes his money. But yeah, like the amount of like, again, food and stuff that people throw away. If you go down the back of a supermarket, of a Whole Foods and stuff, and you open up the dumpsters at like end of time, like at the end of the day, some of the stuff that you get is wild. Like, you could feed a whole family out of these things, and it's good stuff, you know. It's like, it's just happens to have expired that day, but it's not moldy. Like, it's just stuff that, okay, the display date's gone, I'm gonna chuck it away. There's a wild thing that people don't really know about returns in the UK. This made a bit of news a couple of years ago, but a lot of companies, when you send, particularly if you're buying cheap stuff online and you send it back, the cost of them processing the returns is less valuable than the stuff itself. So they just chuck it. They just like, they send it to landfill. or if it's electronics, they'd send them to these facilities and they basically put them in giant shredders. So I went to this facility out in Fresno, one of the biggest electronics recycling facilities in the US. And there was stacks at my head height of brand new unsold TVs still in the wrappers. And they were just putting them in this gigantic blender, essentially. Jeez. It's like the greatest noise and it like the stink and stuff. But, you know, brand new stuff, because they're basically like, well, it's new, you know, it's the time when it's new season, the new stock is coming in. We don't want cheap stuff on the market, like secondhand. They just blend the stuff, like, genuinely. And the scale of it is will blow your mind. Just the size of it makes you feel tiny and insignificant.
I'll tell you what, I'm doing my part. I don't throw away any food.
Well, my kids, I've got two kids and they're going through a picky eating phase, so I'm like not perfect in that way, and I don't want everyone to start thinking you have to be these kind of zero waste influencers where like you're only throwing away like one kiln a jar of trash every year or whatever, because I just don't think
what should it. I do with this bottle of water when I'm done with it right here?
Oh, he probably
take the label off, crush it, put the lid back on, chuck it in recycling.
Do you hate that he's using a plastic bottle?
I'm sorry.
No, hugely. Like I still do from time to time. I try not to. He's got his keep cup. Yeah, good man. Right.
Yeah, but what do you do with a bottle?
Iceshaker.com.
I mean, you got it from a bottle, right?
I've definitely got a lot better, but I wouldn't say that I'm perfect, and I'm not trying to be perfect, right? Like I swapped my toothbrushes for wood ones instead of plastic ones, and I got rid of a bunch of shampoo bottles and things, and now I like little things, but you know, by putting off upgrading my car for like a couple of extra years, I probably saved more than I would have by like giving up plastic for an entire year. So, you know, like the you've got to weigh up the value, and everyone's got to, if we expect everyone to live perfect lives, they just give up because it's too hard. Like the cards are stacked against you. So the thing I say to people is like, try and do your best. If it's something you want to do, there's loads of solutions out there and it's very easy to learn, like YouTube and Reddit, and the things are full of these threads, and there's all these Instagram accounts who can tell you how to live less wasteful lives. But we've got to fix the system. Like if we fix the underlying system, then if that plastic bottle is recycled 8 times, then I'm not, you know, we can feel good about it, you know. I'm not saying that we need to be perfect.
Is moderation a good solution? So like instead of like, how many pairs of sneakers should I own, for example?
Well, that's really up to you. I'm someone who used to buy a lot of sneakers, and now I kind of every time I feel tempted, I manage to kind of fight the urge a little bit more. But you know, we all need to wear clothing, and I'm not saying that you shouldn't buy things that look nice. The thing that I've, you know, you talk about sneakers, for example. The thing that I think about now is how long are they going to last me? You know, like, am I going to buy something that's like made a piece of crap and is going to fall apart after 20 wears? Am I going to buy a pair of Converses and like the soles split after 2 months and then you're throwing them away? I used to wear those shoes and you go through like 2 pairs a year. So I think about that now. The footwear industry, for example, is like suddenly really big converted. You know, like it's impossible to buy a pair of sneakers now that aren't recycled in some way. So we have seen a lot of progress in fields like that. You know, I should say to the readers, my day job is I'm an editor at GQ. So I know a little bit about more than about fashion. And so I understand the urge for sure.
Well, how many books is too many books?
You can never have too many books. They get a special.
I don't know.
They get a special exemption.
How many wastelands is too many wastelands?
I like when people ask me to sign the book, I always say to them, well, make sure you pass it on to someone else afterwards. But you know, like paper is very recyclable, and I'm sure a lot of the books, the paper stock is recycled, for example. So, again. Books. This book will hopefully encourage other benefits, and so in the aggregate, it's good for you. That's my sales.
You want to call them a bleep hole, don't you?
Your publisher hates that. Your publisher.
Buy the audio book. There you go.
There you go. Like that. It's not really like reading, but it's okay. It's listening.
Yeah.
Your publisher has to hate that whenever you sell a book, you're like, why don't you give it to someone else? You're like, no, Oliver, we're selling these.
Right. Buy 5 copies each. It's okay,
Oliver. It's good. I don't tell people until they've given the money, so it's fine.
Oliver, you're doing the good work. You exposed it. You're telling the truth. You're trying to help out. You're pitching in. You're doing your part. So,
well, I appreciate that. I appreciate
buy 5 books. Okay, like everybody. 5 books a person. All right. We appreciate the research. We appreciate you educating us and the audience, and keep up the good work, my friend. This was it was a fascinating story. It's kind of out of my comfort zone, and so when I brought it to these guys and said I wanted to do it, they're like, "What?" But I think we were all fascinated by this. So thank you for the research that you did here.
Well, I appreciate you sticking with me and giving me a chance, and it's been nice to talk to you guys. I really appreciate it.
All right. We appreciate it, man. Mikey said, by the way, he feels like there should be a number after your last name. Like, you should be a third.
Yeah.
Fourth. Franklin Wallace.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or Junior. I feel like if I was an NBA player, I'd have Junior or something off my name. You can't see this, but I'm 6'8", and I was a big basketball player. So there you go.
All right. We appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thanks, guys.
Stu Gatz here for my friends over at Miller Lite. A lot's changed over the years. One thing that hasn't, the great taste of Miller Lite. Another thing that hasn't changed is that it's less filling. So, what is the best thing about the original light beer? Miller Lite sparked this debate in 1975, and we still haven't settled it. For me, it is simple. What I want out of my light beer is ice cold and great taste, and that's exactly what I get from the original light beer, Miller Lite. Miller Lite keeps it simple, undebatable quality, great taste, only 96 calories. It's the beer that strips away everything you don't need and holds on to what matters most, a light beer that tastes like beer. You don't have to choose what's best. Miller Lite has great taste and is less filling. Tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right to your door, visit MillerLite.com/stew, or you can find it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, 96 calories per 12 ounces, fewer calories and carbs than premium regular beer.
Texting privacy policy and terms and conditions posted at textplan.us. Texting enrolls for recurring automated text marketing messages. Message and data rates may apply. Reply stop to opt out. Individual results may vary. Consult a doctor prior to use.
You've lost so much weight. How'd you do it?
I got medical treatment for weight loss through Zelty and lost 50 pounds. I struggled for the longest time, but Zelty makes it easy and affordable to get weight loss treatment 100% online. Zelty providers can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications clinically shown to help people lose weight, like Wegovy, Zepbound, and others.
I've heard those medications can help you lose weight, but aren't they expensive?
Zelty can help get the medication covered by insurance, so it's as little as $0 a month.
What if you don't have insurance?
No problem. Zelty may be able to help you get other GLP-1 medications for 80 to 90% off the price of name brand medications.
I'm ready to start losing weight. How do I get started with Zelty?
Just text.
Text LOSE to 200-300 to get started today with Zelty and see if weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound are right for you. Don't wait. Text now for a link to your exclusive offer. Text LOSE to 200-300. That's LOSE to 200-300. LOSE to 200-300.